It's a Sunshine Celebrity Weekend.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
And you're very welcome to another Celebrity Weekend. And this evening, I am absolutely delighted to be joined in studio by the man who will be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the American Pie Tour, or American Pie, Don McLean. Don, it is an honour to have you in the studio. Welcome to Dublin. Welcome to Sunshine.
Well, thank you for having me. And this is a very nice little studio. I like it.
Don, you're going to be in our company for the next hour or so. I want to start off, first of all, if you could tell me a little bit about your early life and how you got into music. And did you get a sense that you were destined for music, or did you think you might head in a different direction?
Well, I didn't really know anything about the music business. I didn't have... You know, there are people like, Billy Crystal, like his father ran a jazz record label called Concord. So he grew up knowing about the music business and knowing about musicians. It was all very foreign to me. I knew nothing. But what happened to me was when I was small, you know, I'd get in choirs and things in school, in grammar school, and they would test us out for singing, you know, and I would get a solo or something in the choir for a Christmas show or whatever. And my mother would get all these phone calls from the mothers of other kids, you know, saying, "Oh, Donnie's such a wonderful singer," you know, all this stuff. And she would tell me, you know, that these mothers that never talked to her ever, you know, would call her about the fact that I sang some little bit. So I knew that was the first inkling that I had something that distinguished myself a little bit from other kids, because, you know, I was not healthy and I was not a great student or an athlete or anything. That became part of my identity. But after I raised two children, you know, I realized that all children are singers and creative, and they paint and they dance and they're artists, you know, and then they go to school and they have it taken out of them because they have to sit and listen and wear a harness and learn to wear a harness in life. You know, you're going to go to work and you're going to do all this stuff, which is necessary in order for us to have a society. But that's why artists, you know, are on the outside, because they find a way to make a living without wearing that kind of harness. But all that was, you know, in the future for me. All I knew was that the people kind of noticed when I sang.
Did you play an instrument at that stage?
No, I didn't. And so it was really just a thing, you know, that would happen once in a while. And everything else, I was, you know, pretty mediocre. I wasn't a good student. Then I saw First of all, Elvis Presley came on the scene in 1956 in a big, big way. And I was 11. And I saw Elvis. What I love about Elvis was those first pictures of Elvis Presley when he was just beginning, on the backs of his records, the first couple of albums. And I saw a cover of it, but he was already on his way, like, you know, very explosive. And I saw this picture on the cover of TV Guide with him playing a guitar. And I thought, gee, I like that. You know, I like the way that looked. And then I, you know, kind of fell in love with Buddy Holly. And he played an electric guitar. You know, he played a Stratocaster. So there was all sorts of different ways I could have gone, but I didn't really work well with other people. I realized I wanted to do something that was just my own, and that's where the folk thing came in, because later on in 58 and 59, the Kingston Trio were huge, and everybody was singing their songs and playing guitars and banjos, and I discovered Josh White and the Weavers, and that started to appeal to me that maybe, you know, and at the same time that was happening, these little nightclubs were opening around all around the world, all around the country, on college campuses and everywhere. And, you know, guys like me, you know, who played guitar a little bit and sang, could get a job.
And at what stage, Don, did you start writing? What stage?
Well, I started trying to learn to play around 13, 14, maybe. And by the time I was 17, maybe, I might have tried to write a song. But, you know, it wasn't much of anything. I think I saw, you know, I thought that Woody Guthrie, by that time I'd been, in, you know, into Woody Guthrie and Huey Ledbetter and the Weavers and a lot of other people. I thought, well, these songs are pretty simple. You know, maybe I could write a simple song with a chorus. So I think I tried to do that. And, but nothing really was any good. You know, I didn't particularly like anything that I did. And I kept working at it and working at it. And by the late 60s, I had a few good songs. I think I had And I Love You So by 68 or 69.
Well, let me just pause there, Don, for a moment, because what we're going to do now is play And I Love You So. We're going to play Perry Como. You're listening to Sunshine 106.8, Dublin's easy place to relax. It's a celebrity weekend. We're in the company of Don McLean, and this is And I Love You So. That is such a beautiful version of And I Love You So. It was a big, big hit. But many, many other artists covered it, Don, including Elvis Presley. I'm sure it was a big, big honour for Elvis to cover that particular song.
There's a lot of circularity in my life. I got a record of Elvis's in 1956 called When My Blue Moon Turns to Gold Again. And it was a 78, not a 45. But it was a single. A 78 RPM record. It's hard to believe that Elvis was out on 78. People don't remember that, but I had two of them. And because I didn't have a 45 player in 1956. So, you know, I heard that my grandmother and I would listen to Elvis and the Jordanaires, and she loved the way he sounded. And she was quite musical, actually, my father's mother. So then later on, just jumping ahead to the mid-70s, And I Love You So.
Just to interject there, because I have a friend, there's somebody I know who used to present a country music program here. He's retired now. He has a bunch of Elvis 78s, and I had never heard of this.
Yeah.
And he showed me one. I said, wow, okay. Uh-huh. That's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't have a 45. I only got one of those later on, one of those little ones. But my grandmother would comment on the Jordanaires, that beautiful harmony sound that they had. And then my grandmother would sit and teach. I say, you know, how do you do that? How do you harmonize? And she said, well, let me show you how you do that. And she said, let's sing a song. And you sing the song and I'll harmonize with you. And she taught me harmony. You know, I could sit and harmonize with her. Or she'd sing the song and I'd harmonize with her. I'd do the harmony part. So I became pretty good at harmonies above, below, in the middle, all around, you know, wherever, because of her. She got me started. And anyway, you know, so And I Love You So got recorded a lot in the 70s, and then Perry Como had a number one with it in 74. And then Elvis came along and recorded it almost, sang it almost every night in 1977, the last year of his life. And recorded it on the Elvis in Concert record, and I just got a 3 million disc presentation from RCA Victor for that album because my song is on it. So that doesn't end there, though, because in 1978 I went to Nashville and recorded two albums with Larry Butler, and who is in the studio, but the Jordanaires and Bob Moore and all of Elvis's musicians were the A team in Nashville, and we cut more hits. We cut Crying, Since I Don't Have You, Castles in the Air. They all had the Jordanaires on those records.
And can I ask you, did you ever meet Elvis?
No, I never wanted to meet Elvis because by that time in the 70s, he was doing things that I didn't I sort of felt bad for him. You know, I thought he was, something was going on that was not not pretty, and I just didn't want to see that.
I used to present an Elvis Presley program a few years ago where we would deal with Elvis in the early days, Sun Sessions, then Elvis in the comeback day, Elvis with the movies, and then the latter days of Elvis. And that appeared to be the least popular with people because, as you say, there was a perception of unsavory things with management and different people involved. But I don't
know. Well, that's interesting what you said, because Gordon Stoker and I were really good friends. He was the Jordanaires, Gordon Stoker and Neil Matthews were the core, really, of the Jordanaires. And Gordon and I would have a nice chat every Christmas for many years because I brought them to England. We did a television special. I brought them on the road. I brought them to Carnegie Hall about three times and we sang there. And then Gordon and I stayed good friends, and Neil and I stayed good friends. And we always talk about Elvis, you know, when we talk at Christmas time. And he said the Jordanaires didn't want to work with Elvis anymore because the people around him were too evil. Yeah. And they were really aware of that stuff. They didn't want to be around evil people.
Yeah, I've heard unsavory stories related to some of the fans and some of the things. And I don't know. I'm guessing Elvis was oblivious to a lot of stuff that, you know, he may not have been aware of.
Well, I think he was oblivious to life at that point. I mean, you know, he just really was. He was walking, you know, through the motions, really kind of underwater almost. I don't think, I think he made a Faustian bargain, really, to do just about anything for money.
At this stage, we're going to pause for an ad break, but what I want to do is I'm sure you've been asked so many questions about American Pie. I want to ask you one particular question. When it was done, dusted, and in the can, and it sounded brilliant, did anyone say to you, Don, you're probably not going to get this played on the radio. It's over 8 minutes long. Did anyone ever say that to you?
Well, they didn't say anything to me because it wouldn't have mattered. I just did what I did. They liked the song. They bought, United Artists bought the whole record company, Media Arts, on the basis of that album and that song, and then they just cut it down to 3 minutes, and it went to number one. They didn't even ask me; they just did it.
Were you disappointed that the whole lot wasn't played?
No, I wasn't. I didn't. You know, it was all exciting and interesting. You know, it was. You can't imagine the furor that it caused when it first came out. Yeah. I mean, it was such a sensation. You know, I was drawing thousands and thousands of people everywhere. I was on the news. Every time I'd play a city, I'd be on the news. It was
because
big.
If you bought a vinyl, there was the A side was the first part, and when you turn it over, the B side was.
Yeah, that's what they finally went to in terms of a single, a two-sided single. But they used to have to bring the album into the studio to play it on the top 40, because that's how they did it.
Don, how long did it take you to put together American Pie?
Well, I had the album, all the songs on the album had been written, and I didn't feel the album was even close to being what I wanted. I knew I wanted some sort of a culmination, an anthem, something big about America that I could tie all the other songs into. And I was darned if I could figure it out. I thought about a lot of different ideas. And once I got started, it was because I sang the first part of the song right into the tape recorder, right from a long, long time ago, right through the day the music died. Everything came right out of my head and into the tape recorder, and it was almost like a genie coming out of a bottle. And I said, wow, what is that? You know, what am I going to do with it? But I know that's what I want. So I said, I want it to be a rock and roll song. So I waited a while and then I wrote a chorus, a rock and roll chorus. And I said, I'm going to think about where this is going to go. And then a few months went by and I wrote the whole song, another five verses, and structured the song so that the middle verses were rock and roll, and then the last verse was slowed down like the first verse.
And I saw an article in the Guardian newspaper in the UK where I think the guy asked you about American Pie, and you alluded to the fact that, you know, the day the music died, it wasn't necessarily just Buddy Holly, and we know Richie Valens and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper, also died in the plane crash, but you may have alluded to your father. And I often think about the day the music died, Elvis 77, John Lennon 80. It's a song that really, you know, fits everything, doesn't it?
Well, each verse of the song adds another layer of information to the day, to that day. So it starts with the Buddy Holly crash, but then as we go along, more and more things happen. They all happened on that day the music died. So that's why it engulfs and enfolds so much really loss. And that's how it works, you know, as it moves along, each verse gets more intense and more more of an explanation about what happened on this day the music died. And of course, it's a metaphor, you know, really for so much. And I wanted it to be that way. You know, I wanted to say a lot, but I also wanted to leave a lot unsaid so that it would be, it would capture what I was after, because, you know, music and is supposed to express something that's not expressible. And it's also emotional, and it's got to capture feeling. And I don't hear that anymore. Everything I hear on the radio is sort of like rhythm tracks with some sort of garbage, you know, they're saying. I don't even know what it is. But it's not capturing emotion. And I read something, an article or a little interview by Jack Nicholson, who is, you know, retired basically. And he said, I don't think audiences want to be moved anymore. They don't want to be moved emotionally.
I would disagree with him. I just think that somebody needs to do it. I think I would disagree because I think it's the human nature of it. But I do see what you're talking about. For me, and I suppose maybe I'm gone into the wrong area of my life as well, you know, I'm looking at music and it doesn't do it for me as it did before. I mean, I'm just thinking of great artists are lucky if they write one brilliant song in their lifetime, but you come along after doing that and then you write another brilliant song. And I'm going to tell you something. This morning, I had to pick up some dry cleaning and the guy said, "You're busy at the station." I said, "I'm actually going to interview Don McLean." He said, "Wow." He said, "On one song alone, I would go to that concert." And I said, "What song is that?" He said, "Vincent." So I thought, wow. And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "That song, I can play it 20 times. It is beautiful. He sings it beautifully." And I said, "Well, there you go. Get your ticket for next October." And Don, just before American Pie, because you spoke about that, I said, you came along and you wrote another beautiful, beautiful song, Vincent. Where did that come from?
I was in a good place, but it was desperate. You know, I mean, as I said, I was putting this second record together and you know, I basically said everything I had to say in the first record and I was stretching it, you know, really looking for things. And I came up with this idea of the Vincent song from a book that I'd read about Van Gogh by his brother. And the brother apparently had the same mental illness that Van Gogh had. And I thought that, gee, I always thought, you know, the cliche, you know, I thought Van Gogh, you know, killed himself for love or was, you know, went crazy and cut his ear off and all that stuff. Everybody knew the story. And it was a whole different thing. So I thought it'd be interesting to write a song about him. But I didn't get into any of that in the song. I just started looking at his painting and started just trying to write about this person that did this as if the painting was telling me how to write the song. And that's what happened.
And a beautiful melody. Where does that gorgeous melody come from?
Well, that's the Italian in me. I'm half Italian.
I thought there was a bit of Scottish in you as well, I heard.
Yeah. So I'm, you know, I am very sentimental. I'm very easily hurt. I have a lot of pain I've gone through in my life for a lot of reasons. I am defensive a lot of times because I don't want to get in situations. I don't want to hear certain things. They stay with me, and I don't want to hear them. You know, I don't like ugliness. And there's a lot of that now, especially in the music business. Everywhere, actually, is pretty ugly. And so, you know, I'm seeking something in my life, and as a result, I have created some things that represent what I think are beautiful, and other people have found them beautiful, too. So that's what I've been trying to do. And that's what I'm about, really.
The melodies that you create, and when you say the Italian, I think about Puccini, and you know, you're watching and listening to Puccini's music, and you begin to cry nearly, and you're thinking, "Why am I crying?" But it's the construction of that beautiful music.
People don't cry because you're maudlin, or you tell them. People cry because when you sing, because it's beautiful. And it's beautiful to be a human being. It's beautiful to be alive. It's beautiful, and focusing on what is beautiful in life is so important. Whether it's, you know, to me, everything that I surround myself with, whether it's architecture or furniture or music or color or whatever, I'm very sensitive to all that. And one of the things that I noticed today is that people, when they decorate their house, it's, you know, if they're people of means or whatever, it's usually white or gray or, you know, very pale brown or whatever. They're afraid to be colorful in a classy way, you know, and use color. And I think that's something in Vincent. There's a lot of color in that song. You can, it's cinematic also. You can see it, you know, and that's part of it also. I like to try to write in a way that lets you see it. So even when you hear American Pie, it's a movie. It's a movie and a kind of a dream.
Oh, it is.
And that's the idea. So that you're, but it's not done in a way that makes you think that I planned on doing that. It's just what happens when you see it in your head and you tell the story. I tell the story that I see in my head. I don't go and try to do something outside of that. I let my head tell me what I'm supposed to write because it's what I see. And I've tell people, you know, I get these things in on my radio. Sometimes I don't write anything for a year or even 2 years. You know, I'll be involved in something else or, you know, just do stupid things, you know, and waste time. I waste a lot of time doing things. And then, but in the back of my head, there's always something going on. And then there'll be that time when I'm thinking, yeah, I got something I really am interested in doing here. And then I get started. And that's when an album gets made. That's how that happens. But it comes in on my radio.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Dom, because we can't go any further because so many people are waiting to hear the magnificent Vincent.
Starry, starry night.
I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that song is magnificent. Don McLean and Vincent. And Don, after that, you go on and you take on one of the great singers, one of the great songwriters, one of the people who write all these tearjerkers, Roy Orbison, and you take on Crying. What made you do that?
I understood it. You know, I only sing songs that I understand, and I only like songs that I understand. I don't care what people think about me, and I always have to fight uphill with people, even who are on my side, you know, because I'll be in the studio and everybody will be excited. So I'm going to do this song. Why? Why do you want to do that? It's because I have to. You know, something I really need to do. And we were in Nashville. Now, they didn't say that. See, that's the difference between those guys. They didn't. Whatever I wanted to do, they were cool with. But we were making, I was making this album called Chain Lightning, and the Chain Lightning is about 6 minutes long, and it's a long song, a love song, and it's a powerful song about the power of in the forest of lightning striking and, you know, love and all this stuff. And I said, I want to do crying. And so I said, here's how I want to do it. I want to do it slow, and I want it to build so that it's the tension is enormous by the time it ends. So instead of the way Roy does it, which is, I was all right for a while, which is kind of like a rumba or something, I want to sing it, I was all right for a while, I could smile for a while, and it starts to build a little bit more. And it's like that, and it's hanging, and then all of a sudden, and I thought that I was over you, and the thing starts to expand more, and then by the end, it's, and the thing, and the strings are going, and everything, the voices are, you know, and the thing just is exploding. That was my idea, and Larry Butler loved it.
It is such a beautiful song. It's for the hopeless romantics, and anyone who's been through relationships or a relationship breakup, and they hear that song, it's, oh, God, you know. But we love torturing ourselves with those love songs.
But I'll tell you one thing. It was one take in the studio with no edits.
Wow.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Okay. I've got to finish off because I'm under pressure. I could actually talk to you forever, Don, because so many things I wanted to cover, but I've been given the thumbs up that I got to finish off. But what I wanted to ask you is the world as we stand now with COVID-19, first of all, what did you make of the whole lot when everyone had to down tools, whether you were a waiter, a singer? Everyone down tools. The world has changed. What did you make of it, and did it affect you in any way?
Well, I always believe that there's somebody's going to come along, some group, some something, and it's going to change us again. You know, there'll be another amazing thing that's going to happen, and we'll switch in a different direction, you know, and maybe it'll be a more musical direction and a more poetic direction and a more beautiful direction. You never really know what's going to happen, and that's the wonderful thing about living. Is, you know, you people that commit suicide, or it's really sad because you never know what's going to happen next. And I've been low in my life, very low. And I've always had my guitar, I've always had my songs, I've always had my dreams and my ideas, and there were always things that interested me. It's very important to have a lot of interests. That are just whatever you might be interested in, and to keep you happy. Happiness is what you want to find in this life, and music, you know, is there to give that to you. And so I'm always hopeful that there'll be, you know, a big change, and it'll be for the much better, you know, and I think that that's quite possible. So, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Okay. Well, listen, Don, it's been a pleasure. I can't wait. October, again, just the 7th of October, the day after my birthday. So there you go. And I'll be there, 3 Arena. It's a Friday night, the weekend to look forward to, the 50th anniversary of the American Pie Tour. Don McLean, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
I was all